Listener supported KTOO, welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, gonna chi, shawa, toksunusum, salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You can also join us via our live stream on YouTube at ktoo.org/JPM Live or over on KTOO's Facebook page. Conversations for today, January 8th, 2026. A preview of the next Death with Dessert, Death at a Ranch, happening this Saturday, January 10th. Ed Schoenfeld and Betsy Longenbaugh are here with a preview. Get a new pet as a holiday gift or thinking of adding a furry creature into your family? Well, we'll talk licensing and vaccinations with Juno Animal Rescue and get you up to speed on everything you need to know. And today, we begin with Spruce Root. Spruce Root, a 501c3 community development financial institution working across Southeast Alaska to support a regenerative economy, has an upcoming workshop that they are offering. It is called Leading Through Uncertainty, a masterclass for entrepreneurs. It's a workshop designed for mid-range entrepreneurs and focuses on helping participants build a grounded understanding of regional change. It's happening January 23rd through the 25th, and the registration deadline is coming up tomorrow, I believe, January 9th. But we can find out all those details and when those deadlines are, as I'm pleased to be joined by Elena Peterson, Executive Director of Spruce Root, who is, I think, joining us. Are you joining us from Sitka?
Yeah, Sitka Kwan.
Nice.
This is where I grew up.
That's where you grew up. Awesome. Well, Gunath Cheesh, Ha Yigudi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here. Wasiati, how are you today, Elena?
Yeah, Gunath Cheesh. I'm doing really great. It's great to be here and joining you for hopefully a great little discussion on what's going on with Spruce Root.
Yeah, absolutely. So Happy New Year, of course. And we've had Spruce Root on over the years since I've been doing the show. A couple years, 2 or 3 years now I've been doing it. Had so many of your colleagues come on, but it's so nice to have the executive director here to give us sort of the overview and also dive into some of these details about upcoming classes. So let's start there with the overview in terms of, I guess, just what is Spruce Root? Let's start there.
Yeah, sure. Well, like you said it well, we're a nonprofit. We're what's called a CDFI. That's a designation that we get through the U.S. Department of Treasury. And CDFIs exist all over the United States. These organizations are stood up to help improve access to capital for underserved communities is sort of the tagline. And so in Southeast Alaska in 2012, our native corporation, Sea Alaska, decided they wanted to stand up a native CDFI that would improve access to capital for Alaska natives in the region and specifically people in the rural communities in Southeast Alaska. And we're all rural at some level, but for our purposes, we really consider those communities to be the ones outside of Sitka, Juneau, and Ketchikan, where access to traditional financial services are usually limited. And oftentimes those folks are at the whim of industry and sort of left out of the economic opportunities. And so Spruce Root was stood up to help address that. And over the years, we've grown from to be much more than just a lending institution. So we do have our loan program, which provides small business loans up to $500,000. And so we do that. And then we have our complimentary business client services program, which provides workshops, one-on-one coaching for members of the workforce and entrepreneurs on business themes. And then we have financial literacy workshops and classes and one-on-one coaching as well. And so those two together really work in concert to support our small businesses and entrepreneurs across Southeast Alaska to get access to the resources that they need to thrive and be successful. And then we also have a program called the Sustainable Southeast Partnership. And this is really a major key factor in how we do and how we operate here in a good way. So community and economic development often are sort of top down, like here's the solution and you should do this. We really find that that doesn't work ever, not in the long run. So as an organization, it's been really important to us to have really close and intimate knowledge about what priorities are in our communities and for anything that we do to support that, right? So we don't come in saying this is what needs to happen or with a big industry push of any kind. Like it's really just what does the community need to continue to exist in this place and how can Spruce Root support that? And so the Sustainable Southeast Partnership Network has been a really integral part of our ability to know and have access to that information. And so this is a network, the Sustainable Southeast Partnership is a network of over 120 individuals and organizations that work collectively and collaboratively across Southeast Alaska to build a future in which we can continue to exist here, specifically in those rural communities. And so it's a very community-informed network. And so it allows us to stay apprised of what those priorities are, understand what strategic planning is that's going on in the region. We work closely with tribes and municipalities and other NGOs. And so those three programs together really comprise like what Spruce Root is and who we are and what we do. And so we're often involved in many projects and programs across Southeast, most of which people don't ever know about, which is great. We're not really here to take credit for anything because like every project is owned by someone else. We're just here to try to be a driver or an engine to make sure there is a thriving economy here, one that is informed by what the people here want.
What is, you know, it's interesting because we hear these words regenerative and sustainable and I'm really curious about like, what are the main, because it's Southeast Alaska and it can be so isolated, especially in the smaller communities, what are some of the challenges that come up that you've seen over the years that you all are trying to work through?
Well, I mean, there's very real like tangible challenges, right? When it comes to cost of living, access to healthcare, cost of transportation, energy costs, you know, those are all tangible things we all know about. I don't need to talk about that. People understand those challenges, but I think the solutions are there. And what often stands in the way of our ability to drive forward on those solutions is our ability to connect with one another and work together effectively. So a lot of Spruce Root's work does look like facilitating groups of people to come together and move through a process together. And so that facilitation support is really what creates a space or a vessel for a group of people to be productive. And we, you know, we all run into these challenges in our day-to-day lives. And so communication, having trust between individuals and entities, that's really core to, it's highly correlated to like the success of an initiative or a project. And so Spruce Root has invested a lot of time and resource to try to help collectively build our capacity to work together, collectively build our capacity to be more trusting with one another and understand that that takes time and have difficult conversations. And I think that's where most people in community or in economic development especially don't talk about that. Oftentimes economic development is all about the dollars and the jobs. And those are the outcomes. Yeah. And what we find is that those matter a ton, but we can't focus on that. We have to work on where we're at and what do we need right now to get to those outcomes. And in Southeast Alaska, it's been a lot of, spending time with one another and ideating together and being okay, like working through a messy process. And so Spruce Root creates a lot of spaces and opportunities for that to happen.
Yeah, I feel like it's, you know, if I distill it down from what I'm hearing, it's basically like two words, connection and access, like being able to have access to the various, obviously the programs, the the financial aspects of it all, but also the access to connection, right? So that then the connection
that's a great way to put it.
Can sort of, you know, like you said, ideate, have ideas, bring up new solutions, things we haven't even thought of yet, which is really kind of cool.
We have such amazing people here, and we can do anything with, you know, our human capital that we have here. Our capacity is impressive.
Like move snow out of the way, which is, I know
we can move some snow.
I know you all are having that issue right now too. It's just, it's sort of taken over the conversation here. It's pretty crazy. That's great. Well, okay. Thank you. So you're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm talking with Elena Peterson from Spruce Root. We're talking about what Spruce Root is as a entity, a CDFI institution here in Southeast Alaska to support a regenerative economy. And I'm Boston Christopher. And we are also looking at some classes that you all are going to have coming up. I know I put up the flyer for the other one that's coming, but you have one that I think you said has a deadline of today. So let's talk about that mini class that you have, and then we'll get into the other one real quick here.
Yeah, we have a mini financial wellness class that we decided to offer at the beginning of the year here. It's a virtual 2-hour class. So it'll be from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. on January 12th. Today is the last day to register. If you are thinking about your financial future or thinking about, you know, New Year's resolutions that are related to financial wellness, this is a great opportunity to like just spend 2 hours dedicated on that. We're going to talk about some goal setting and strategies to like stay on a goal that really is tied to your values. And then you'll get to meet Haley, who does a lot of our financial wellness courses, and she does our coaching, and she's a great resource for anyone. All these services are free. We do sometimes ask for like a registration fee. This has a $25 registration fee, but if that is a barrier, just let us know and we can waive it. Sign up for that today on our website if you're interested.
And that's sprucerout.org. That's where you can find it, all this information. You also, Spruce Root's very active on social medias, on Instagram and Facebook, and they post these classes that are coming up or the deadlines that are happening. So that one is happening. You want to get signed up for that. Everybody needs a little bit of a redo at the beginning of the year, you know, to sort of like, what is my goal for this year? What do I need to actually accomplish? And what's the tools I can use to do that?
And it's nice to do it with other people.
Absolutely. Groupthink is one of the best things you can have. So let's talk about this masterclass that's coming up between January 23rd and 25th. Again, you can find out more about this at sprucerout.org. If you're on the stream, you can see a little bit of the flyer here. But Elena's going to give us the rundown of what this workshop is and who it's for. So what are we talking about here? Leading Through Uncertainty, a Masterclass for Entrepreneurs. What is that?
Yeah, so this is for mid-stage entrepreneurs, specifically people who have at least 1 year of business operations under their belt. So this is for people who are not like startup or early stage. We want to focus this on helping those who've already been operating a business spend some time not in the business, but rather working on their business. And that's such a hard thing to do as an entrepreneur. I know that firsthand. And so creating some space January 23rd through the 25th, 3 days in Juneau to sit down and think about what's happening macro and microeconomically, how it impacts your business, and coming up with some strategies. So we're going to bring in a bunch of external folks to talk about different themes, including climate change, leadership, different skill building as it relates to artificial intelligence tools, marketing, planning for extreme weather events, you know, all these things we unfortunately are reactive to. And you can be proactive as an entrepreneur if you take space like what we're going to offer here. So we keep getting asked by entrepreneurs who've been through our other workshops to deliver a follow-up sort of 2.0 class. So that's what this is. Mm. I'm excited about it. It's going to be in the Sea Alaska Plaza event room, which is a new space that they just finished down in the Sea Alaska Plaza. And so, come join us. Please register. You have until tomorrow to sign up. and there's still some space.
So you have tomorrow to sign up. That's January 9th, if you're listening to this. And this is limited to 25 participants. Now, I do notice on the flyer here, Elena, that it says that travel stipends are available. So is this, again, yes, like the other classes? This is no cost? It's just people have to get here.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah, this is an in-person class. And so we recognize that for people outside of Juneau, that's a tough thing. We do have up to $250 for travel stipends if you want to come in from outside. If you are finding you really want to come and you're just having issue, you know, making it possible, reach out to us. Let's chat about it. We want to see if we can help you make it happen. So we do have those travel stipends, and we've got people from Juneau and not Juneau coming. But the in-person workshops like this are great too, because you build off of the entrepreneur network, which as an entrepreneur myself, I know is so important to have. It can be a lonely journey. And so spaces like this help you connect with other entrepreneurs, learn from one another, share ideas, stay connected, collaborate. So it'll be a good time for that in-person connection.
I love that you are responding to the feedback too from the folks who've been through your other workshops, the Path to Prosperity program, which helps people get started up, right? And things like that. So to be able to have this class, which is, you know, that continuing journey of education as you're going along and figuring out what's coming up for you in terms of business. Now, there's one thing in this poster that I want to ask you about and just get your opinion on, because it's an area of real interest for me. So, And where you're finding this in the CDFI, I want to talk just a little bit, because we're almost done here, but a little bit about AI and what your thoughts are on it and what you're seeing in the community developed financial institution space about AI and, you know, the complications with that. Obviously, there's different kinds of AI. There's generative AI. There's AI that's helping your business, that kind of thing. So where do you stand on that, Elena?
Well, personally, where I stand is it's complex, and I am a little nervous, right? Like I feel like I'm a millennial. I lived through crazy changes like the internet and cell phones. And so I feel like I understand how quickly life can change when technology just shifts everything. And the level of change that this is going to have, I can't fathom, which is what freaks me out. So I'll just say that. All of the climate impacts that we're all aware of as it relates to like data centers being built, but technology will continue to evolve. And so I'm hopeful that we'll come up with a more climate friendly solutions for how we're going to generate enough energy to be able to, you know, keep up with the level of energy resource demand that AI will continue to, like, it's only going to grow and what it currently requires. So those are things that, you know, I don't have a lot of control over. But at the same time, AI is here. It's not going anywhere. And we got to hold our elected officials responsible and accountable to creating smart legislation. So there's that. And then as users, like as an entrepreneur, for example, we can utilize generative AI like ChatGPT or Claude or Notebook LM, these different ones, to help us save time, energy, and resource and do a better job of delivering whatever product or service we provide. And it can make us better at what we're doing. So it's complex. And we're going to dive into all of this at the workshop. And every person, I think, has to be well-informed and make decisions that are aligned with their own values. And so we're trying to give enough information so that people can do that, that you feel more informed and able to make decisions and teach some of the tools and things that people could be doing with generative AI for their businesses. But all that being said, it's a tough time to be navigating this change and feel, you know, it's hard to say that you feel totally good about it.
Yeah, you bring up one that I think is sort of the unseen, which is the energy required and the warehouses and databases and places where things are stored for all this, which is we don't really see that as consumers of it. We just are using it. Even as a business owner, I may not even come into contact with that. But it's definitely something to think about. Elena Peterson from Spruce Root Executive Director, thank you so much for coming on the show and joining us from Sitka, Alaska, to talk a little bit about Spruce Root and also the Leading Through Uncertainty, a masterclass for entrepreneurs happening January 23rd through the 25th. You must register by tomorrow. It's really easy. Just go to sprucerootorg. There's also the mini class that Elena talked about a little bit earlier that you can find out about to set your financial goal right for the year of 2026. Deadline for that is today. So get yourself over to sprucerootorg. Get yourself signed up. Elena, it was a pleasure to talk with you. I look forward to chatting more with you in the future.
Yeah, let's do this again. Thank you.
Ganesh Cheesh. Have a good one. Thank you so much. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. We'll be right back with the Juno Animal Rescue. We're going to talk about licensing and vaccination.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
You're listening to KTOO's Hinget Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kushtuk-U, Bill Fawcett, and the word this week is Guakan.
Guakan.
That means deer. And here's a sentence. A deer is going to walk out on the point. Perhaps I'll see it. Let's hear it again.
Guakan.
Deer. Gunesh Cheesh Tchne Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Kushtuk O'ish Bill Fawcett was Slukach Adi and the child of a southern Toshone man who passed away before Bill was born. His mother later married Tsihua Bill Fawcett, who helped raise Bill. He lived on Akkwan Ani and enjoyed working with advanced language learners, helping them answer difficult questions about the language.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
A big gray wolf is trotting across the green muskeg on Prince of Wales Island in southeast Alaska on a summer morning. She catches a whiff of something and starts casting about for the source of the scent. Nose down, she finds it and drops to the spongy muskeg and begins rolling, rubbing the back of her neck against the moss. Satisfied, she hops up and trots off. What was she rolling on? A closer look reveals a square plywood board. A short strand of barbed wire is tacked onto the board. This is a hair board, placed here by a wildlife biologist studying the wolves on Prince of Wales Island. A few drops of scent on the board caught that wolf's attention. That's not all it caught. She left a few strands of her hair snagged on the barbed wire. The hair follicles contain DNA, which will enable the researcher to identify this individual wolf, determine its gender, and understand her relationship to the other wolves on Prince of Wales Island. Hair snares like this are a non-invasive, passive way to collect DNA from a wolf without capturing it or disturbing it. Hundreds of samples like this are giving biologists a better understanding of the wolf on Prince of Wales Island. Sounds wild. I'm Riley Woodford.
Is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher, and joining me now in studio are two representatives from Juno Animal Rescue, specifically Animal Control. I have in the house with me here, I have Jordan Bales, who's the Director of Animal Control. Gunath Cheesh, Wasiati, how are you today, Jordan?
Good, how are you doing?
Excellent. And we also have Officer Jacob Miller, who is an officer with Animal Control. Animal Control. Awasi Iti, how are you today?
I'm doing well, sir. Thank you so much for having us on.
Of course. It's such a pleasure to have you here. And I was saying as we were coming into the studio here, I was like, oh, yeah, I never think about animal control. I never think about related to Juneau Animal Rescue, right? Because I'm always thinking of Juneau Animal Rescue, you know, with the cats showing up on Facebook and the cats are for adoption, or myself going and looking and seeing, do I want to get another cat or do I need a puppy or whatever it might be. But animal control is a thing, right? It is a thing, and you all are part of that and making that happen. So can you tell us a little bit about the animal control operations here in Juneau? I guess we'll go to you,
Absolutely.
Jordan. You're the boss. You should know, right?
Yeah. A lot of people have some misconceptions about what animal control does. A lot of people, due to a longstanding media misconception, is that we run around with big nets and all we do is capture dogs.
Yeah.
We do that, but that's a small percentage of what we do.
We got you. You do it. You do it. No, yeah. It's all good.
We do it. Small percentage.
Yeah.
Mainly, our goal is education.
Mm.
For the city's ordinances, the Chapter 8 ordinances are what we are designed to.
And what is that ordinance?
So it's a list of ordinances
okay.
pertaining to animals.
All right.
From their welfare, vaccination, rabies exposure, dogs at large, barking. It covers a
okay.
whole list.
All yeah. kinds of things. Okay. Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. So you are the, I guess not force, but you are the organization that sort of handles the implementation and governing of that ordinance, right?
Correct.
In terms of making sure that happens. Now this covers things that don't even have to do, I mean, our domestic animals, cats, dogs, you know, reptiles, things like that. But you're also dealing with other kinds of animals too, right?
Not necessarily wildlife. It's pretty much domestic and livestock is what we cover.
Domestic and yeah. livestock. Okay. Okay. I see. So now I know I mentioned in my intro today earlier that we were going to be talking about licensing and vaccination. And so let's talk a little bit about that. If I get a cat from Juneau Animal Rescue, or if I get my somebody gives me a cat from a friend of mine has a litter of cats and they're trying to get rid of it, or I pick one up off of the, you know, side of Costco or something where people are giving them away, do I have to get that animal licensed and registered?
Not cats. There's no licensing requirement for cats. It's just for dogs within the city and borough of Juneau.
Okay. And why is that?
You know, that's a question we ask ourselves as well. Currently, we're in talks with the city assembly and amongst ourselves about whether or not cat licensing should be a thing, should be a requirement. Because one of the reasons why we have dog licensing is not just for, oh, you have a generic license, here you go. But it's also a means of identification and also a way that we track rabies documentation. In order to procure a license, you have to have the animal currently vaccinated for rabies.
I see.
And so it's definitely something that we are talking about as far as bringing cats into the equation for licensing.
I see. Okay. Yeah. And I mean, my cat is an indoor only cat because mm-hmm. When we adopted him, he didn't have any front claws. That had already been declawed. He would never survive out there in the wild. But I'm sure there's a lot of cats that are outdoor cats that maybe not even have like a collar on or anything. Mm-hmm. So if they get lost, I mean, I know people also chip cats. Is that a still thing people do, right?
Absolutely.
You do the chip thing so that they can be, and that's sort of a way to register them. That's not necessarily licensing them, though, right?
Yeah. Registering them, we always scan animals for microchips, and it's a fantastic way, a means of identification.
Yeah.
There are so many times where we have stories of cats being lost for over a year and a half.
Oh, wow.
And someone just found the cat one day and said, oh, well, I guess this is my cat now. And they come in for routine vaccination. We scan it for a microchip and say, oh, my goodness, this is someone that's been missing their animal for over a year.
Mm.
And so it's, you know, part of why we're here is to help animals get reunited with their owners. I think that's one of the big things. And that's licensing really helps with that. A story I have recently is that someone called us and said, there's a dog out here, doesn't look like it has an owner, showed up, it had a 2025 license. I was able to immediately look up where this person lives, who this dog is, several phone numbers of not only the person who's the owner, but also a secondary contact. I was able to load up that animal and drive right over to their residence. They didn't even know the dog was missing. There was a hole in their fence.
Wow. And
here's your dog, you know? And so licensing is very important for the health and safety of the animal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, you mentioned that dogs have to be licensed. Are there other animals that I might have domestically? Like if I have a Komodo dragon or some kind of reptile, do I have to register that as well?
As of right now, it's just dogs.
It's just dogs. Okay. So so no fish, no other kind of reptiles, no... Yeah, because those – and why dogs specifically? Do we have an answer to that in terms of, like, what's the reason to license the dog?
Yeah. So back in the 60s, animal control had an issue with a feral dog population. There was dogs roaming left and right. Juno Animal Rescue, back then Gastineau Humane Society, was a little shack under the bridge. There was one officer. He was going around catching feral dogs, and as you know, feral animals are typically aggressive, unhandleable. Mm-hmm. There was a high euthanasia rate. There was high risk for rabies. So a lot of those animals were being euthanized. Licensing was a way to be able to track Juno's dog population, as well as the ordinance dog at large, keeping your dog from roaming freely.
Right.
Puts a danger on not only them, but traffic areas. You know, a lot of the times we hear people swerving out of the way of a dog running around and crashing and injuring themselves. So it's preventative.
Okay, cool. And I know we've mentioned it a couple times, this idea of vaccination. Why is that important? Why is vaccination important? Why should I be doing that for my animals?
Alaska actually has a very, very high concentration of what we call vector species, which are the wildlife that are able to carry and transmit the rabies virus, which once symptoms show, it has a 100% fatality. It is a very, very dangerous virus. When it comes to rabies vaccination, a simple $40 vaccine that you can get at JAR, every Tuesday during our vaccination clinic, immediately stops that chain of transmission. And it's, even though Juno is not an endemic area, we do have vector species. In fact, we have confirmed rabies in bats around Juno. Jordan has a story of recently one turned up at Twin Lakes. And he had to run over there because there were dogs out there, there were kids out there that were wanting to
pick it up,
play with the bat.
And so, yeah, it's definitely an issue and definitely something to be on top of and make sure that your animals are protected.
Yeah, and I think it would also help for in cases where an animal, let's say your dog gets loose, gets aggressive with somebody and, attacks them or bites them or something like that, right? Like that, that's where it would be important to, because you don't know what would happen then, right? What does it save? It saves you some hassle, I would assume.
So rabies is transmitted through bites, through saliva, to blood contact. So what that does, whenever that happens, we have to confirm rabies status. If they are not current, we have to put that animal under quarantine for protection. It's a 10-day quarantine, and the reason why that is if an animal has rabies that is transmittable within that 10-day period, that animal would start showing symptoms and die within that 10-day period. And then we know we have to get it tested. The person bitten needs to get a slew of rabies post-exposure vaccines.
Those are the ones you have to do, like, in the belly, too, right?
Okay. It's gotten better over the years.
It used to be 12 vaccines every week.
That's what I heard,
One vaccine of a 12 series every week. Now it is down to three or four, I believe. Okay. So they're getting
better.
It's not
as bad as it was. I do remember that. And I was always scared of that as a kid because you heard 12 shots. What? Oh, no. Yeah.
And it is not a fun time. I've been vaccinated for rabies, and it is very draining. A lot of fatigue, pain. It's not a fun vaccine to get.
And it's pretty easy, as Jacob said. You do a vaccination clinic every Tuesday over at JAR, yeah, and it costs $40. So
absolutely,
get your dogs in there at least, and if you want to get your other animals in there too, I'm sure that's a possibility. Right?
Yeah, it's by appointment only, but you can always call JAR and get a scheduled appointment. And yeah, it's great.
So I'm curious about, what does a typical day, because, you know, you start, you open, Jordan, with the idea of, you know, these cartoon images of you all with nets and stuff. Like, what does a typical day for a Juno Animal Rescue Animal Control Officer look like? What do you guys do every day?
It starts with coffee.
So
coffee and donuts, just like every other officer, right?
Yeah. So typically, our schedule isn't predetermined. It's all about the community reaching out to discuss issues that they're having, whether it be with the neighbor, dog at large, barking, whatever it may be. We start a case and activity, and we reach out. A lot of the times, we try and stay away from, you know, punitive measures such as citations and what have you, and stick to education and fixing that problem.
I see.
So if someone calls saying they're concerned about the health of a dog, you know, our first goal isn't to, we're going to go take this dog away. We want to educate them and make sure that they know proper care, whether it be food, shelter, medical, and assisting these people to provide better care for their animals.
Yeah. That's good. Education over, you know, citations is probably a great way to start, right? Sometimes a citation is unavoidable, but, you know, it depends on the situation, I guess. And then last question for you. This weather we're having, what are you all seeing in terms of its impact on animals and your role as animal control? Is there, you know, what are you seeing in your daily life right now?
It makes it extremely difficult, especially with people that have never experienced this much snow. I know I haven't. I mean, this is a little wild, but one of the issues we're running into is people that are used to being able to let their dogs into their back, fully fenced in backyard.
Right.
Suddenly they do that and the dog can now just hop right over the fence because of the berms.
Yeah, the snow and is so tall.
Yeah, so we're getting a lot of people that are just like, oh my gosh, I didn't even, you know, the dog never runs around anywhere. And it definitely is making it extremely difficult. We're definitely having an uptick in calls.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then currently right now, you know, there's the potential for avalanches. Red Cross is working through City Hall about potential evacuations. They're working with us about providing safekeeping and boarding for people and that may have to evacuate who have nowhere to bring their animals so they can stay at Centennial Hall. So that is always an option for people. We have safekeep programs for people in the hospital or domestic violence shelters or where they have no other options. So
that's
natural
good.
Disasters is one of them. So we're working on that right now and letting the public know, bring your animals to us. We will keep them safe while you deal with the evacuation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's so important. You can find out more at JunoAnimalRescue.org. Is that where people can learn about animal control and also find the phone number for, I'm giving you a call. Do you want to give the phone number out now?
Our number is 907-789-6997. That goes directly to Animal Control. So one of me or my three other officers will pick up and answer any questions you may have.
789-6997.
Yes.
Okay, that's where you call Animal Control. Because, you know, people might be seeing loose animals. Like you said, they're getting over these berms, right? It's nice to give Animal Control a call so these dogs and animals can get back to their owners. It's pretty amazing times we're in right now. But Officer Jacob Miller and Officer Jordan Bales, the Director of Animal Control, thank you so much for coming in and sharing a little bit about animal control with us. Gonna cheese for being here and come back and visit.
Absolutely. Thanks for having
us. Appreciate it. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Up next, we'll talk with Ed and Betsy about death with dessert.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years. with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Step in to the savory moment. The classic everything blend you find on bagels and just about anything else these days, from steaks to salads to guacamole, varies by the cook, but it reliably contains these five ingredients: sweet poppy seeds, nutty tasting sesame seeds, savory onion and garlic flakes, and salt. This combo is nearly perfect as is, but some bakers sprinkle in extras to create their own signature blend, and you can too. Here are three options for spicing up your own everything blend. Caraway, with a mild licorice flavor plus notes of citrus and pepper. A caraway everything blend would be great on a creamy potato gratin. If you like a hint of hot and bitter, try brown mustard seed. Sprinkle your mustard seed blend into onions, caramelized with ginger and garlic, then pile on top of an Indian dal. A third option is coriander seed. With its fruity, almost floral essence, coriander and lamb are a classic pairing. These seeds are big, so crush them a little, then sprinkle this everything combo on a Middle Eastern pita. And finally, don't forget seafood. For a signature blend with extra flourish, add all three of these seeds, caraway, mustard seed, and coriander, to a mix of panko, grated Parmesan, and lemon zest. Then use it as a crunchy, tongue-tingling breading for halibut. Sear the halibut pieces in olive oil until golden and intriguingly fragrant. Then serve on a bed of salad greens with your favorite tartar sauce. Find the full recipe for everything breaded halibut at savorymoment.org. From the studios of KCAW in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Beth Short-Rhodes. Whatever is on your dinner table tonight, may you savor the moment.
You are listening to Juneau Afternoon from Studio 2K, dedicated to Carolyn Hobbs Peterson at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That was a savory moment with Beth Short-Rhodes. Another kind of food you can have is death with dessert. Imagine this. A man is shot in 1914 at a ranch in Auk Bay. Then a remote outpost far outside Juneau city limits. Two other people were present, and one was the killer. But which was it? This mystery called Death at a Ranch is the first of three historic presentations by True Crime Alaska at McPheeters Hall, the Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, this winter. It's this Saturday, January 10th. You can visit True Crime Alaska for more details. And those presentations are the work of Betsy Longenbaugh and Ed Schoenfeld, who join me now in the studio. Gunath Cheesh, Wasiati, how are you both today?
Oh, we are fine. We are driving the car on the roads.
That's made exciting. It here.
That's yeah. a thing.
That is a thing. Yeah.
I know. Luckily, I was off for the holiday break, and I don't think we would have had shows anyway. So it worked out.
Yeah.
So now, the times you've come on before, sometimes the presentations are already sold out. So I just want to get this out of the way. Is this one, can I still get tickets?
Yes.
You can. We just checked on that before we came over, and there are a few tickets left, which is unusual. I think it's because of the weather. Because there's this monsoon coming, apparently, we're actually looking at a way to virtually provide the presentation in case we have to. That doesn't
pivot.
Mean, unfortunately, that we can virtually provide cupcakes, but we're working on it.
Yeah, the dessert part. I guess you have to provide your own at that point.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of funny. Now, you do these as a – are these still a fundraiser
for the church?
The Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, right?
Yep.
Okay. And you do them downstairs in the McPheeters Hall
where
a lot of people go see theater and stuff like that. So you'll be down there doing this presentation. And this is on Saturday. And this is the first of three that are going to be happening. There's another one in April called The Love Nest Death. That's really evocative. I like the idea of that one. And then another one in May you're going to be doing called A Woman Strangled. That's a little more direct,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's right.
Some titles are subtle, some aren't.
Now, I also know that, Betsy, you have another book coming out. You've done two books previously. You did Forgotten Murders from Alaska's Capital.
Yep.
And then that was a nonfiction with a lot of these stories that you've presented. And then I think it was last year you had Death in the Underworld, which was a narrative that you'd based on and expanded with your imagination a little bit about one of the cases. But now, and if I looked it up today, is this coming out next week?
Yeah.
It's going to be available next week.
On Wednesday,
On Wednesday, and this is called More Forgotten Murders from Alaska. We've dropped the capital.
Yep.
It's just More Forgotten Murders from Alaska.
Broader focus.
Yes.
More towns.
We have more towns, right.
More. The word is more.
Yeah, more towns. More of everything. More death.
More mystery. Yeah. More murder.
Now the next time we're trying to figure out what would the third book be. Even more.
We hope you're not sick of.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about Saturday's adventure, Death at a Ranch. So tell me a little bit about where this one came from and what we're going to be learning on Saturday.
Well, first of all, the word ranch seemed to be interchangeable with farm. And when we look at the stories from around 1914 in Juneau, people often called their farms ranches. So far as we can tell, there were no ranches per se. There were dairy farms and there were vegetable farms.
Okay.
We're pretty sure that this particular farm where this murder occurred was actually out in Auk Bay and was a vegetable farm.
Okay, yeah, because I was thinking ranch in Juneau.
Right.
I can't even imagine what that would be.
Cowboys,
I think of ranch as like, you know, 1,500 acres. And yeah.
No, exactly.
There used to be a lot of agriculture here, especially Auk Bay and in the Mendenhall Valley.
Cause yeah.
Among other things, it was drier, there was more sun, and you could get flat land and just have more elbow room to do what you wanted. But, of course, you know, air travel and barges and all that made it largely unprofitable
to do
any of that, although certainly there's been a resurgence in locally grown veggies and a few other things of late.
So it was an interesting kind of new perspective for us on this idea of locally grown produce and dairies. Ed just delved into an enormous amount of research on that, and it just was absolutely fascinating. And then this early homesteader, we just showed you a photo of him, the man who'd never combed his hair.
Yeah.
And he was also quite a character. And it was his ranch where the murder occurred.
Mm.
And one of the two people who did not die, of the three that went out there, was his 14-year-old son.
Mm.
And the other one was a 27-year-old Tlingit woman from Douglas, who was born and raised in Douglas. So there's a lot going on in this story. There's a lot about Ed has researched and written and will be telling a lot about the historic Auk Bay settlement, the village, and sort of what happened to that, as well as perspectives on, in this particular case, Alaska Native women, women in general, and who do you believe?
And how the justice system treated people differently depending on sex and race.
Yeah,
yeah,
which
absolutely.
Is no surprise to anybody who pays attention, but still, historic documentation's important.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about 1914, Ed, and when you looked at this time period and what a farm or a ranch or something like that would be, what was it like? What are we talking about, 114, 112 years ago or so?
And
what was it like?
Well, of course, we've never been there, and we can't find pictures of much of anything there other than his daughter as an adult washing vegetables.
Uh-huh.
But the fellow who had this ranch, the homesteader, Wes Wadelick, and Wadelick Creek, which still has his name, he was a prospector and a farmer. And when he came to Juneau, he tried to do some prospecting. He didn't find much of anything. But he farmed. He knew people wanted fresh vegetables, maybe fresh fruit. I'm not sure what they could have grown here. But they did kind of the standard vegetables. And then he would load them up on his skiff and row them over the Mendenhall Bar down Gastineau Channel into town and sell them.
Oh, wow.
And my favorite story there, or image, is Barron's, which was the big kind of department store, grocery, everything else, had a big display of his vegetables in one of their windows. And there was a picture there of a giant turnip.
I think it was a giant.
And a giant icicle. and next to each other with a sign, both grow in Alaska.
That's so funny because we're talking about, and not a lot of people know this, but around this time, right, 1914 or so, this is when Douglas was like one of the biggest cities in Alaska, right? Mm-hmm.
It was all of 1,700 people plus more in Treadwell, which was its own town for a while, right next door with the mine.
Yeah.
And the greater Juneau area included, about 5,800 people, mm-hmm. which made it kind of the biggest census area in the state.
Wow.
Actually, those are 1910 numbers, but they're the closest we could get.
Yeah.
But yeah, Douglas was a big deal.
So, and in that time, because you're talking about also like, and I know we've talked a little bit about this on the show before, but the way people were treated, especially the indigenous folks and especially the indigenous women, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to give everything away that happens in this mystery because you got to go and find out, right?
Right, absolutely.
But, and this one, you said, Betsy, mm-hmm. this one's not in any of the books.
Nope.
Right?
Nope.
So this is a sort of brand new.
It is.
Yeah. And so I'm just curious, like, what's the basic, issue at hand here? Was it jealousy? Was it,
initially it was who killed him.
Okay.
And then it was once they figured out who they thought had killed him, it was how does that person create a defense?
Oh.
And then what happens with the trial? So it's a very rich story. When I first started working on this whole project now, like 7 years ago, I did a study of, created a spreadsheet actually of murders I could find in newspapers on digitized newspapers through chroniclingamerica.com, the Library of Congress site. I came up with about 80 murders between 1900 and statehood. Mm-hmm. There are definitely more than that. Those ones were the ones that popped up, had a lot of news coverage. And this, so when we were trying to come up with something new, because we don't want to tell something we already know, we wanted to delve into something new this time. We looked at the spreadsheet and came across this story. And it just had so many elements that mm-hmm. were new to us that we really wanted to tackle it. And it's turned out to be just absolutely fascinating.
And did you, when you see that list on the spreadsheet, do you mm-hmm. see this one, you say you get the basic story there, but mm-hmm. then what happens after that? I know Ed does a lot of research and you sort of try to uncover it, but are you doing this all through like archival documents basically?
Yep. So I do the initial newspaper research, which has been digitized. Ed then goes over to the historic library and reads newspapers that have not been digitized.
Oh, wow.
And there were in a particular
Juneau
case,
had a lot of newspapers.
And a couple of them were very good at doing trial coverage, but they have not been digitized by the Library of Congress. So this was one of those that we popped up. Ed found a couple of articles that had a lot more trial coverage, which is we rely upon heavily. While he's sitting there, I'm next door in the archives going through court records.
Mm.
And again, this case had a little bit more in court records than we normally see. Mm-hmm. I have literally opened court files on killers and seen one piece of paper.
Oh, wow.
There was just a lot that got tossed from what I've been hearing when the territorial documents went into the state.
Mm-hmm.
It was right around the same time they changed courthouses, and there's stories of piles of paper just sort of floating around the old courthouse that I think just got tossed.
Wow.
So this case had a little bit more, which is always helpful. Mm-hmm. And because some of the people in the case had earlier criminal histories, we also were able to look at those court files, and that was also very informative.
And does this, I didn't mention in the intro, mm-hmm. but you both are former journalists. Mm-hmm. Ed, mm-hmm. you've worked for Coast Alaska mm-hmm. and at KTOO in the past, and you, Betsy, worked for the Empire, mm-hmm. I believe. And mm-hmm. so when you're doing this, when you're in the library and you're reading these newspapers, you're getting these notes, does it get the juices flowing?
Find yourself going down many, many, many rabbit holes.
Yeah.
I find that just looking at court records because they'll give you a box and and the box is full of files, and at the top of the file it will say what the person was charged with. Mm. And some of the charges are so crazy that I just have to look at them. Cohabitation.
Oh, interesting.
Not cohabitation in the state of adultery.
Oh.
Versus cohabitation, just cohabitation, I guess it was.
No, isn't it a state of... I can't remember what term they use, but basically of not being married to somebody.
Oh, in the state of fornication.
Yeah. That's right. Much better word.
Yeah, so I told Ed once, so is it better to be in the state of fornication or the state of adultery when you cohabitate? And so, you know, you find yourself just like Ed does over in newspapers. I find myself opening up these files and just going, wow. And they are actually helpful because when I start, especially when I look at sexual assault files and what happened, and I can tell you I have yet to find a sexual assault charge that resulted in a conviction.
Oh, wow.
In the early years. Yeah, there are very few of them. There are very few people charged. And so far, the files I've looked at, nobody's been convicted.
Oh, it doesn't mean it wasn't happening. It just law enforcement wasn't willing to follow up, or the victims didn't want to go out
there. Didn't want to
put themselves out there, which is understandable.
Yeah.
So there's big chunks of things that then play into, are informative for us when we tell this story.
Yeah.
These other little bits of pieces that, and like I say, Ed has the same thing.
And then you get your creative juices and you kind of distill it down into a presentation that then you give to everybody. You get rid of all the nonsense details, give us the core.
Yep.
And some of the nonsense details are a lot of fun.
It's so true.
Yeah, obviously you got to get the quirky ones in there for
that's
sure.
Right. That's
I mean,
right.
For example, most important thing that happened in 1914 was not this, but Juneau's first recorded automobile accident happened then.
Oh.
When a Model T missed a corner and ran into something and couldn't find out how fast it was going. But later that year, city leaders passed a bill or an ordinance putting up a speed limit of 8 miles an hour. So possibly this Model T was going 10.
I think it is currently the speed limit.
I was just going to say, that's about what we're driving is 8 miles an hour.
Bumpy, slippery, snowy highways.
It's Death with Dessert. It's Ed Schoenfeld and Betsy Longenbaugh. They're going to be presenting this new case, Death at a Ranch from 1914. It's the first of three historic presentations from True Crime Alaska, which is Ed and Betsy's little adventure, I guess.
Yes,
yeah. It's going to be at McPheeters Hall at the Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, weather permitting. If weather doesn't happen, I'm sure you're going to put an update on your website or something to let people know.
Yeah. I mean, likely it will be there, but we would have a simultaneous Zoom feed or something.
Okay, I got you.
So
right.
Yeah. Folks who don't want to.
Because people want to come get the dessert.
Because they got to get
and
the dessert.
And they do.
So the tickets are all available through the church, actually. You want to go to the
TrinityJuneau.org/dessert will get you to the ticketing area. Yeah. And those desserts are provided by Treadwell Kitchen, which I believe is your daughter.
Our daughter, who is actually a nurse manager at Bartlett, but has created Treadwell Kitchen to make donations to nonprofits. She gives cakes to groups. She does these wonderful desserts for us, and she occasionally does cakes for special occasions for friends and family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But
it's not
a business, so don't bug her to make cookies for your party because she has another job.
Just go to Death with Dessert and get them there. So Ed and Betsy, thank you so much. Good cheese for coming in. Break a leg this Saturday, and we look forward to more cases in the coming months.
Great.
Appreciate you being here.
Yep. Good cheese to you.
Thank you.
That will do it for today's Juneau Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, Mudroom Storytelling Event Preview, plus a new course on healthy relationships from Aware. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. here on KTOO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Ok Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. You can find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh.